Yeah, no, Mojave's been fine. I haven't had any problems.
Cool.
I didn't even have to do like my yearly homebrew patch.
Oh yeah, that's always is my user local gonna come over? Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. There's always something where I have to search the GitHub and then I have to paste a command into the terminal to fix things. Always. And this year there wasn't a problem.
That's good.
Yeah.
Mojave. It's a long E apparently. I always want to say Mojave, but that's wrong.
I don't know if it has anything to do with me not running the beta this year because I didn't do the macOS beta at all. So maybe that's what it was previous years where I would run the beta and that stuff hadn't been sorted out yet, but no.
They had a lot of betas, like 12 betas or something come out.
Yeah. So what's funny is that every time a beta comes up, my mom messages me and she's like, they're going to mess up my projects because every time they drop an Xcode update, things are just broken, apparently.
Oh, dude. Yeah, Xcode is, yeah, definitely not great sometimes.
So she messaged me yesterday or 2 days, whenever Mojave dropped, I can't remember, 3 days ago maybe? I can't remember now. She messaged me and she was like mad because she had the Xcode update paused for a while and that worked. And then just one day they forced it through.
Oh, no.
So she was like, no. So she had to go through and fix all of their builds. But yeah, I haven't had any issues myself.
Xcode has gotten better because like when you're trying to compile things on the command line, you have to switch the Xcode version. You know what I'm talking about?
I don't.
Well, so like if you go to Xcode preferences, there's like you can have basically in order to support older versions of things, you have to have multiple versions of Xcode installed.
Sure.
Like not just major versions, but like minor versions as well, like dot revisions, because really? The newer versions don't, like at some point they just stop supporting the old frameworks. And so you have to keep around these gigantic, you know, each of them is multiple gigs, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to keep them around for a long time. And then each version of Xcode comes bundled. Like every time you switch, so there's a preferences screen and you tell it like what version of Xcode you want to use for like Make or, you know, GCC or whatever. And it just switches the whole system around just from a little drop down. And then like you get a completely different set of tools on the command line. Yeah, I don't know. It's super weird and it's annoying when you forget and you're like have to go back and change it.
That does sound a little frustrating.
It's gotten better. It's better than it was. It used to be like you didn't even know what version you had to use a command line thing to switch them. And yeah, it's a whole thing. Every time I go back and use Xcode, it's been like, because I have to update, you know, just do updates to my iOS apps, just keep everything kind of, you know, modern and working. Everything's completely different and I have to like relearn it. Not because I forgot it, because it's different. I don't know, man. It's just long enough. I have these long enough cycles where it's maybe, you know, 6 to 12 months and a new version of Xcode drops. And oh, man, it's just so frustrating. It kills all my motivation to work on those projects, to be honest. But
so what you're saying is it's not just limited to JavaScript?
Different kinds of problems. Different kinds of problems. Okay. It's not that kind of churn. At least there's only one thing changing.
Yeah.
Churning, but not all of them.
Yeah, I'm glad I don't have to deal with any of that stuff. I mean, so in picking up IntelliJ, I do have to worry about, oh, did I set up an SDK for this project I'm working on? But that's a 20-second thing.
Yeah.
And I have to think about it once, and then it's set. So that's what it reminded me of when you said you have to change. If you want to work on different versions, you have to actually use settings in the IDE, which is Xcode in this case. And yeah, so I'm just really glad that I don't have to worry about all of those crazy things. That's why I like the web, I suppose, because it's open. I don't know.
Yeah, but the nice thing about having a real compiled application is you compile it and you know it's going to keep working. Like, you know, you don't have to worry about supporting, you know, you can test all the possibilities in terms of like browsers and support and people's setups and stuff.
Sure.
But
yeah,
that's also getting more difficult with the different screen sizes and different devices and yada yada. But
fragmentation.
Yeah. And also I have to remember, because like when I started, I was like, oh, I would just pull in dependencies from GitHub. I just clone them and put them in there and be done. And then I was like, oh no, use CocoaPods. So I use CocoaPods and that's the dependency thing. And I learned that. And then it's like, oh no, CocoaPods sucks. Use Carthage. And I was like, okay, I'll use Carthage. And it works in a completely different way. And it's broken in a whole new way when I have to set it up. And now I'm going full circle. I'm just like, I just want to pull the dependencies and just be done. Like, just if I want to update them, I'll just clone them again and throw them in there. Dependency management is still a major issue. And like Swift, there's a Swift package manager, I guess. I don't know. I haven't even played with it, but there's like a bunch out there now.
Yeah, it sounds like a whole thing. I just stick to NPM, and I haven't had any of the major issues that people have been talking about. I guess I use Hex too. Hex, the Elixir dependency manager.
Did you ever use Yarn?
Briefly, but I didn't really ever have that many problems with NPM anyway, so.
Yeah, and to be honest, like, NPM adopted most of Yarn's good features, I think. So I think most people are just back to using NPM.
Yeah, I've never really had many of the issues that people were reporting or suffered the same symptoms, I suppose. So, but then again, I'm not the past, like, it's been almost 2 years. It'll be 2 years December. I mean, I've been working on the same project and my dependencies haven't really changed much. Even going from just a Vue app to a Nuxt app, things have been pretty fine where I haven't had to add a bunch of things or change a bunch of things, and I haven't had to recompile a bunch of stuff. I don't know. It hasn't ever been an issue for me.
No, that's good. In fact, I actually upgraded. Nuxt 2 came out within the past couple of weeks, and I just changed the version number and NPM install, and everything has been pretty fine. I mean, the app is pretty small in scope, but
sure.
I haven't had any major issues. I did have one weird display issue, which I still need to track down, where, like, normally Vue.js is really good about taking the white space out between tags. So, like, if I had two span tags and there's a new line between them in HTML, that actually will show up as, like, a space in the browser, because that's what it is. It's white space, and just kind of collapses it down into one space. But for whatever reason, the way Vue.js works, it is really good about, like, taking that white space away. So if I have two spans next to each other, like foo and bar, it's just going to jam them together, which for doing layout and stuff, that's what you want. You don't want to have to deal with random spaces everywhere. So something changed with the Nuxt upgrade where it started putting those spaces in, and it looks like in the inspector, there's a bunch of, like, empty comment blocks, which is weird because even in places where I don't have comments. So I don't know where those are coming from.
Yeah, but. Yeah. So there's a setting. I can send this to you after we're done recording. But there's a setting, I think, that you can use to turn that off globally for Vue. And it used to be it would, I could be remembering this wrong, but it would put comments in the HTML around components. So, like, before and after components to help you kind of isolate which blocks of HTML would be in coming from a component. It wouldn't say, like, the name or anything. It just has a comment in there. But I'm pretty sure you can turn that off. I'll send you a link later.
Interesting. I definitely didn't notice that before. That's something new. So maybe I'll do it. Well, good. I'm glad.
Yeah.
Glad you brought that up.
Yeah. I'm glad I don't have to deal with it. That's Paul's,
his domain,
Paul's game. Yeah. His domain now. So yeah, I just have to deal with a lot of Elixir things. But how's your week been?
Yeah, it's been good, man. I can't believe it's just flown by. It's been crazy busy in the good way, you know, slowly banging stuff off the Trello board and moving it over one little card at a time. And I've been working so much in front end stuff, and then going back to work on, you know, it's just jumping around and messes up my syntax a lot. It's really bad. Entering, you know, return statements or forgetting return statements, depending which way I'm going. Semicolons, all kinds of, you know, just the regular stuff. But yeah, you just kind of have to laugh at yourself when that happens.
Paul messaged me, or we were talking yesterday, and he had to get something from the mix. We were getting some data from the Mixpanel API, and he was using the Ruby client for that. And he was like, I don't know how to write Ruby anymore. and I've actually been, remember how I've been saying for weeks, I haven't written Vue in, like, months, or haven't done any JavaScript in months. Well, that changed, this week. So now I had been up to that point doing lots of backend changes for a big feature that I'm introducing, the company's change. And so now I have to implement that on the front end side, and have to change, like, onboarding, and I have to change, like, the store admin area, and I have to add a whole new admin area for companies and stuff. So that's all done in Vue. And yeah, so I've been in Vue a lot, and, like, I mean, we have, like, prettier setup and we have formatting, so I don't have to worry about that stuff. It just kind of happens for me, which is nice, but it is kind of, it's just a different paradigm, a different way of working and thinking. So that's been a little, taking me a little time to get back into, but I'm feeling pretty okay with things now.
I will say that having prettier setup on the JS side and mixed format setup on the Elixir side, like, having those automatically trigger when you save, that makes programming Ruby feel broken. Like,
really?
Like, I know you can use, I don't know if RuboCop, but, like, there's Ruby formatters out there. None of them were really to the liking of, you know, what I really wanted. So I haven't found I haven't started using one yet, but having the formatter automatically format on save, not only is it just a saves you a ton of time and headaches, but also like it's kind of a sanity check, because the way mixed format works is it actually parses the actual abstract syntax tree, right? It actually like more or less compiles it, right? So you get like almost real-time compile warnings for like individual files if you messed up something, right? Or warnings or whatever. So that's kind of like nice sanity checks, because you don't, you know, with a compiled language, you get that as soon as you mess something up, it red squigglies it or whatever, right? But that's nice to have that feedback loop. And the same for JavaScript as well. If I forgot a comma or semicolon somewhere, although it inserts semicolons for me, but you know, if you mess up the formatting somewhere, it's just a good like, oh, okay, I typed a whole bunch of stuff and hit save and it formatted it. So at least it might not be correct, but at least it's the right syntax. So I like that.
It's funny because mine removes semicolons for me.
Oh no, are we having that debate?
We're not gonna have that debate.
There's a really great Stack Overflow thread about semicolons versus not, and then it's not so much the question, but there's like the series of comments underneath it that are like, 2015 reporting in, semicolons are out, 2016 here, we're using semicolons again, back and forth.
That's funny. Yeah, I just have been using standard JS for a while, and so I don't know, I like how it looked, so I just used it, and that's where that kind of came into play. But yeah, you're right, I kind of use the mixed formatting. So when I was using VS Code, it would obviously mix format on save. And if I had a syntax error, just I would notice that things wouldn't reformat, and then it would be like, okay, something's broke, let me find it, you know? And that was, like you said, kind of a nice litmus test. And one thing I'm noticing with IntelliJ is I have mixed format going as well. But I don't know if it's like IntelliJ doing this or if it's part of, I don't know how the IntelliJ Elixir plugin works exactly. The README is gigantic, so I haven't gone through the whole thing yet. But I'll notice little things like the syntax highlighting will change if, so say I have put name, and that function is the arity is 2, and I'm calling put name in another function somewhere, but I try to give it 3 arguments. I notice that the color leaves the function name, so it turns gray. And then I didn't know what that meant for a while. And then I realized, oh, if I'm actually calling a function that doesn't exist, if I'm using the wrong arity, it technically doesn't exist. It doesn't color the function because it doesn't exist.
Oh, wow. So, okay.
Yeah. For a while, I was like, why is this a different color? That makes, I thought it was like just IntelliJ being slow. And because that's like a thing I'm trying to fight mentally, is I've always heard people say it's really bloated and slow, which I haven't really experienced yet. I guess it depends on how many dependencies you have at indexing and stuff. But anyway, I noticed like small things like that where, oh, this thing is like a very subtle change. Like I noticed in JavaScript, if it's a global function, the function name is actually italicized versus a function that's block scoped is not italicized. So there's like all these small little cues I'm learning to look at. And it's kind of cool. It's a lot at first, I guess, because I have to stop and think about, what does this mean? Is it actually meaning something, or is something just broken? But yeah, it's kind of a neat little detail.
Yeah, it's nice. And then you kind of internalize what those little subtle things mean, and then again go back to a real editor, a simpler editor, and that doesn't have those features and feel lost. Right, it's like going back to Notepad.
Yeah, and it's. And I'm not trying to fire shots at VS Code. I still think it's great, but it's just different. Yeah. it's just different. I've never really experienced using IDEs before. I mean, back when I did try like IntelliJ way back when, or when I tried WebStorm, I was like, what the crap is this? And my computer was just, old. I had a really old computer at that point. So it maybe didn't make the most sense to do that, but things have been fine.
That's funny, because I've had like the opposite experience where I learned on Visual Studio and visualstudio.net and Visual Basic. So like, I don't know if you've ever used like the real Visual Basic for like doing any kind of stuff there, but their autocomplete has always been, they call it IntelliSense, I think. It's always been awesome, like from day one. You type dot, you know, some class dot, and like every method, every property, like everything comes up for you, and it's only gotten better, right? And you get used to that. You lean on that as like, oh, I don't need to read the docs. I'll just keep hitting dot and scroll down until I find what I need, right? The .NET framework is gigantic, and the only way you can navigate is with IntelliSense. Otherwise, you'd lose your mind because there's just so much, and there's so much nesting and everything. And
yeah.
So I had that, and then like, I came when I eventually kind of migrated over to Unixy style of development, I was scared at first. I was like, I don't have access to these tools. Like, how am I going to find things? How do I know it's right? How do I know, you know, you don't have the red squiggly lines telling you something's wrong until you run it. And, you know, eventually you adapt to that and know how to read documentation and, you know, but it, that was scary at first. Cause I felt like I was leaving a lot behind.
Mm. Yeah. It's, I feel a little bit that way when I do use VS Code for some stuff now. And I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, because I feel like I don't want to become lazy and have a tool do all this stuff for me. But sometimes I want that because I enjoy programming, but it's like, there's a discussion I used to have with Paul. Like, I used to program as a hobby and now I do it out of necessity. And so there's a difference in between how much time you want to spend doing something as a hobby versus how much time you want to spend doing something as a necessity or a job.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I don't know. It's a new experience for me, for sure. But
well, that's like last week you were talking about, switching BThink over from, you know, to like a server rendered thing. It's like, it's just kind of, you know, you want to tinker, but you don't want to be spending all your time on something that you don't need.
I didn't do that.
Oh, okay. Is that going another direction now, or is that for another topic?
No, maybe. I probably won't. I'm doing that. I did do some other stuff to it, but I didn't do the server rendered thing.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to that another time, but we should get on with our topic for today.
Yeah.
So
the topic.
We wanted to keep talking about some of these cool ElixirConf videos. And since I randomly went first last time, I think it's only fair.
Oh, okay. Throwing me under the bus here. Yeah, I'm still, forgive me, because my brain is still moving slowly. Just before we started recording, I ran a rather large migration.
What, in your brain?
On my database. And so now I'm still kind of like churning through all that stuff. So I was organizing my Trello board and I was filling out a checklist before we recorded. So it's still chugging. But anyway, the video that I watched in the ElixirConf 2018, the video that I want to talk about was about testing. And it lines up well because I've been spending a lot of time writing tests the last couple of weeks for this big feature update, the company thing I keep mentioning. But yeah, so the video, some of it was just over my head. So he ended up talking about property-based testing a little bit, which isn't what it sounds like it is, or what you imagine if you don't know what property-based testing is. So I won't really go into that a whole lot because I kind of watched it and didn't have the capacity to remember exactly what he was talking about at that point. But what I did like was actually the first half of the talk, which I found really interesting. And so he's basically asked the question at the start, like, why do we write tests? And he asserted that, you know, most people will say something like to prove that a program is correct or to prove the absence of bugs. And he said there's a whole, his answer was kind of funny. He was like, there's a whole field in mathematics called formal verification that has proved that you can't prove that a program is correct just by writing tests for it.
Oh, it's like an NP-hard thing or something.
Yeah. I was like, wait a minute. So I went into the Wikipedia article and I looked up formal verification. And again, this is one of those things where I glossed over it to kind of have an idea about what it was, but I didn't have the capacity at the moment to actually internalize most of this stuff. But I'll read the first sentence of the Wikipedia article that says, in the context of hardware and software systems, formal verification is the act of proving or disproving the correctness of intended algorithms underlying a system with respect to certain formal specification or property using formal methods or of mathematics.
Well, that's catchy.
I was like, all right. Yeah. So again, maybe there's a book that came out called about property testing recently with Erlang. And I kind of want to pick it up. So maybe we can talk about that in a future show, kind of like I can dive into that a little bit. But the takeaway there is that, you know, people will say we write tests because we want to prove that a program is correct or that it doesn't have bugs. And he's like, well, it's impossible to do that with tests. And so really like the first half of his talk was, and I don't mean to discourage anybody because I still think tests are important, very important. But the first half of his talk was about how important the personal side of testing is. And so he talked about how important QA is, how important click testing is. And so I think exactly what he said was, so then why do we test? And he said, the reason why we test is to find bugs. A successful test suite is one that reveals a bug and not necessarily one that reveals the absence of a bug. And I thought that that distinction there was really interesting. A successful test suite is one that reveals a bug that exists, which is interesting.
The way I've always thought of it is like, if your tests are red, like that's a good thing. Like that means you're finding bugs, right? If you write tests that are all green, yeah, like you said, you don't know, you're not going to catch the absence of a bug, right?
Yeah. And I think when I first started getting into testing, like there's this term that people use called happy path, right? So the path that everything goes fine and it leads to the expected result. So for a while, when I first started testing, I was like, this feels strange because I'm just at that moment, I was just writing happy path tests and I was like, oh, this should happen and this should happen and this should happen, you know?
Surprise, it happens.
Surprise. Yeah. I was like, okay, this is cool. And then something unexpected happens. I'm like, why did my test catch it? Like, well, because I didn't write a test to look for that. You know, I only wrote a test to capture the happy path of my code. So it was kind of like nodes in my brain connected when I listened to this talk. I was like, oh, this makes a lot of sense. The whole reason why I want to write a test is to prove that a bug exists and then fix it. Right. So, and I guess maybe it's also different for me because this is my first product gig where I've worked on the same project for a long time at a stretch. Like 2 years is the longest I've ever worked on one project. And so Paul and I, what we've been doing is anytime a bug comes in, no matter what we're doing, tests get written for it. And so the first thing that we do when a bug comes in is we write a test verifying the bug exists. Then we fix it and we write tests to verify that the fix worked, basically. And that's been really successful. So we haven't had a lot of reoccurring things popping up, that's the whole point. That's why I would run and write a test, you know, to make sure like if something happens, we fix it and it's documented, here's how it happened and here's how it's fixed. And it seems to work really well. The first half of his talk was all about how important, like, well, first of all, it was about like why we write tests. And he was kind of saying, you know, you can't verify everything's going to be correct, but what you want to do is expose bugs and then fix them via your tests. And a huge part of that is having not relying too much on unit tests. So I think you've probably seen the image associated with this before. So like someone puts a lock on a door and you can't open it one way, but it swings open the other way because the lock maybe wasn't bolted onto the other side of the wall, right? Mm-hmm. And they're like, unit tests, the lock works in isolation, the door works in isolation. When you put them together, they don't work, right? So that's an example of how a unit test can fail. You could unit test component A and component B separately, but if you never test how they interact together, you don't know that the system actually works, even though your unit tests pass, right? And so he was talking about how a sustainable and a healthy testing setup relies on a number of techniques, whether it's unit testing, whether it's acceptance testing, whether you're like writing automated browser tests that runs around and clicks on buttons in the browser, utilizing code coverage, and utilizing these things called model checking and property-based testing, which again, I'm somewhat familiar with them, but we can go into them in a later episode. But he was talking about how you kind of have to like rely on all of them evenly. You can't have unit tests be the most important thing and then sometimes use acceptance tests because that exposes a weakness in your system. And the opposite direction also exposes a weakness in your system. And so he was talking about how important it is to have, I guess it's like eating food, right? You need to be eating food that has lots of different vitamins. You need a variety of vitamins in your diet, right? And so you need a variety of methods of testing your application to make sure things are working properly.
Yeah, unit testing in Elixir is kind of interesting to think about because, one way you could think of it is like, if you have a unit test and an integration test, right, a higher level test, like an integration test breaks, it tells you, okay, something broke. But like if an individual component fails or part of a component fails, like you know what broke, mm-hmm. right? And maybe why, like immediately. But in Elixir, like your pieces are kind of small, like immutable structs, you know what I mean? Like and models and the way like change sets work, for example, a very common unit test is going to be testing that your change sets and your validations work right on your model or your schema. Mm-hmm. But like they're so like simple and functional and already broken down into little pieces. It's like, it's almost what's even the point of testing it. Like, it's going to catch it at a higher level. So I can definitely see where a balance of those kind of things, like you don't want to be, like you said, you don't want to just be writing the happy path and just like wasting time writing stuff that you, you know, is going to be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. What I think one of the my favorite things that he said, I actually wrote this down as a quote, so I remember it, but he said, you can't forget the human part. At the end of the day, bugs are subjective and they involve humans. And no matter how many times I think about, this is me saying this now, no matter how many times I think about how people are going to use my app, I don't actually know how people are going to use my app. And I can't tell you how many bugs have come up because someone did something I would never would have expected a person to do with their computer. And that's been one of the most difficult things to catch is trying to think about how, in what way can someone do this the wrong way? Or in what way can someone use this feature incorrectly? And what's interesting is I've found myself as time goes on, that's how I'm starting to think about stuff. It's not, I'm doing less and less of the happy path. Like, well, the user has to do A, B, and C, and then it's going to work. And my brain starts to default to how can they bend the pathway from A to B, and how can they bend the pathway from B to C? And is there even a pathway from A to C? Can that be bent? You know, he was talking a lot about how much his team learned when they went and did user testing and they just watched people use the system that they built. And he was like, what are these people doing? And they expose, you know what I mean? They expose like a whole series of bugs. And so I'll do that with some of my friends, or I'll be at a coffee shop like, hey, can you click around on this? Like, sorry to bother you. Can you click around on this? I'll buy you a coffee or something. And I notice it's like almost every person uses a computer differently. And it drives me crazy when I watch people use your computers, because I'm like, oh, you're doing twice the amount of work or something, you know, or that's not exactly how that's supposed to work. But that's how, like, that's the reality that we live in. We build software for humans, and the humans, like, everything they do is subjective. People can be doing different things and there's no way to predict it. We can try to guide them via UI and via different conventions in how we lay forms out and how we explain errors and things like that. But at the end of the day, people are just going to do almost anything. So that has to be, that he was saying, that has to be something that you account for, is user testing and click testing, how important that is. And in the last few months, I've been relying a lot on, you know, writing unit tests and even some acceptance tests and testing, because I'm doing a bunch of Stripe integrations right now. So testing my interactions with Stripe via bypass, and that's great to an extent, but what this video really pushed me to do was spend more time and budget more time in for just click testing.
Yeah. If anything, you're the worst possible person to click test it, because you already know how it's supposed to function, what to click on, what order to click on things, you know, what order to do things in, when not to close the browser. Like, yeah, you have lots of baggage, mental baggage there.
Yeah.
That's going to prevent you from doing the wrong thing, especially if you're staring at it for so long. You even lose sight of, like, is this even a good design? Right.
Right.
Like, you get so used to it.
Yeah. I guess, like, for a while I was thinking about, like, click testing is almost, it's not a waste of my time because it's still important, but I was feeling like it was inefficient in a way, because it's not something I can necessarily automate easily. I guess if I'm using, there's programs that you can use to, like, script the mouse movement through a browser. I think one's called, like, you can use, like, Selenium Test or something like that to do it. But it takes time to set that stuff up. And then if design changes, you have to go and change all the tests. But it's not really that much different than if you're changing the API of your system, you have to change the tests to reflect that as well. So I had this concept, or this notion in my mind, that click testing in the browser and trying to break it myself was an inferior way of testing in a sense. It's not. It's a pretty important aspect of testing that I've been kind of neglecting. So that was my main takeaway from the video, was, hey, you should be doing this more.
Interesting. So you feel like you're actually relying, like, too much on the actual just tests?
Not that I was relying too much on one side, but more so that I was neglecting the other side because
got it.
Of
okay.
A misconception I had. That might mean the same thing. I don't know, but I don't feel like I was relying on one more. It's just felt more time efficient, right? So if I have a lot of stuff to do, and if in my mind, click testing and going through the process manually a whole bunch with my hand on my mouse, that's, to me, that felt like wasted time. right? Whereas the other avenue of testing was automated. So
yeah, and especially Elixir makes it so fast. Like,
yeah, it's so fast. We have, I've been slowly removing, so I have tags. I have tags set up in my tests, so I can tag a test external if it hits like a Stripe test API or something like that. And so we're running almost 600 tests now in, without the external stuff set up, it's like 20 seconds.
Okay. That's pretty awesome.
And it's like everyone, like most of them are hitting the database. So
yeah, I was going to say it's slow, actually slower than I thought, but 600 is 600 is a lot.
Yeah.
And it's going to be all database time at that point.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, like it's running through Docker, so it's going through all the bindings and.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. So it could be faster, but I don't need it to be faster. I haven't, you know, it's not like I'm waiting minutes, 20 seconds, and I don't even run all the tests on every change. You know what I mean? I can run stale. And so that way I'm waiting 5 seconds or something when.
Sure. Sure.
When things change. But anyhow, that's what I gleaned from that video was, hey, don't forget about this other thing. And maybe that means I need to, if I feel like I'm wasting time, maybe I should look in, because I know there's solutions. What's the really popular one that people use now? It's
Capybara?
Well, not a driver. It's like a service that you can use called, oh my goodness, github.com. I know Spectrum's app uses it. Not SpecFM. Spectrum. I'm sorry, everybody. I have to remember what this is called now because it's actually pretty cool. Okay, with Spectrum. So I'm looking at with Spectrum.
But if you do go to spec.fm, make sure you check out our job board.
Actually, spec.fm uses them as well, if I'm remembering correctly, on the new site. Because Brian remade it with Next.js, and he's using Cypress. That's what it's called.
Cypress, like the tree?
Cypress.io. Yeah, so Cypress is, there used to be similar things like Nightwatch, and it's just Selenium testing. And so what you do, you can basically just script a mouse to click around the UI. And given your data is set up a certain way and all that stuff, you can assert like, hey, make sure that this page loads or this thing happens or this error message just is displayed. So it's just acceptance testing. But it's acceptance testing that runs in reports like Circle would or like Jenkins would. So when you push something up, you could actually have a mouse click around on your UI whenever you push a change to GitHub.
And it's running just some kind of headless Chrome or something, really?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Anyhow, what I was trying to say is maybe I should look into something like that, because if I feel like I'm wasting my time doing it by hand, maybe I should just script it once and then have it rerun every time and see what happens.
Sure.
But that's a little bit hard to do if you're still designing stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, it might be interesting to try and just like a small set of things, or so maybe like a new thing, like you're building out this new UI for the companies. It's like, maybe if I just try it for a couple of them and see how it goes. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, if anyone has any suggestions on that, please tell me, because you could probably save me a lot of time.
Cool.
Yeah. So I talked for a while. I'm sorry. What did you have?
What? No, that was good. That was really good. It was really interesting. Yeah. So are you done, by the way?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you done?
Maybe. I mean, I could spin it back up if you want. I could.
I could be here all day. Yeah. So I've been following this guy. His name's Boyd Multerer. And I saw him, I went to two Elixir Conf's in 2016, 2017, and I saw his talk at both of them. Boyd is a ex-Microsoft employee. I don't know, he was a manager slash developer. He basically managed the team that like made the original Xbox and like worked a lot on Xbox Live and like is a game developer through and through. And he's super, super smart and interesting and also very paranoid. Because you can imagine working in the gaming industry, security is like everything, right?
Yeah.
So he picked up, he really truly believes that like Elixir is the future for so many things and likes to talk about why that's so. And it really hits home, like when he hits on all the major points of all the, you know, concurrency and fault tolerance and all the like free stuff you get for Elixir, why it's so important. And so he's been working for the past year and a half on a pure Elixir UI framework, right? Because everything that we do and everything that's done in Elixir and Erlang is all just basically backend stuff, right? APIs and server-based things. But he wants to have a real honest-to-God cross-platform UI framework, which is awesome. And so he released it, and it's called Scenic. And he actually did a great, he did like a mic drop at the end where he kept teasing throughout the whole talk. He's like, it's going to be live soon. It's going to be open source soon. And at the end of the talk, he goes over to the GitHub repo and clicks make public. And everyone applauded. It was great. So Scenic is cool because he just did it from the ground up, and it relies very, very heavily on all the best language features of Elixir. So like individual components, so like UI components, buttons and text boxes and drop downs and sliders are each like individual processes. A window is a process, right? A group, you know, within that window is a process, and so on and so forth. And it's really, really cool because like if it throws an error, it just crashes and starts up again, right? It's an honest to God, like you can start Observer and you look at the supervision tree and you can see every individual control on there. And in his demo, he actually had like a UI and had a button that just said crash. And you click crash and it would throw an error and the console would spit out all this red stuff. And you would lose a little bit of state, obviously, but the UI kept working. Mm-hmm. Like it just kept functioning totally fine. Just restarted right back up.
That's, I wish that were...
It's wild to think about, right?
Yeah, I wish that were a thing. Like, oh, my menu broke. Never mind. Here it is again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if you had an IDE that was made out of this and something crashed, I guess, I mean, most IDEs now have some sort of plugin architecture and plugins on a different thread. So if it crashes, it's not a major deal. But that's very, very cool.
Yeah. And so that's like the main core sort of advantage of this building things this way. In addition to being cross-platform, that you have to like use underlying drivers to like get it to the screen. Like it, right now it only runs on, I think he said Mac, Ubuntu, and some other flavor of Linux. Mm. But like, you know, eventually they'll have drivers for different OSs and stuff, but in devices, but you don't have to worry about that as the developer. You just use the driver for whatever you're compiling it for.
Yeah, that seems really cool. It seems like the whole like embedded scene has been really picking up with Elixir too, with the NURBS project and all that.
So that was actually his big focus on this. He's not really designing this for use for like desktop style applications. He's really, really heavily focused on IoT, right? Mm-hmm. And so he wants a full NURBS install with Scenic running to be like 20 to 30 megabytes.
Wow.
Right? Like low resource, fast, and secure. That's his goal. He outlined that at the beginning of the talk, the actual, you know, the high level goals for it. Because without that, you know, it's easier to kind of develop when you're kind of informed by those decisions.
Sure.
So his main thing was he wants to keep in terms of security, right? Like keeping the brain, quote unquote brain, on the device itself, right? Not having the UI be remoted somewhere, having the device itself be autonomous in the sense that it can run if it loses connectivity. It can run if the company that supports it disappears forever, right?
Right.
You know, he used examples like trucks for whatever reason, like cement trucks or something, managing the systems on a truck. You think about that and you think about, you know, how long a truck lasts and like how long a tech company lasts. that could be two very different numbers.
Right. Like all these little IoT devices coming out and then the company just being like, nope, never mind. Like Juicero comes to mind.
I have a backup camera, a license plate frame that has a backup camera. And it was actually developed by, I forget the name right now. It's escaping me. But yeah, it's really cool. And then they went under, and now I'm never going to get an update for the iOS app, which is already broken. Hmm. So like, it's basically useless. Anyway.
Yeah, this seems really interesting. I'm looking at the core Scenic library GitHub repo, and like you said, he has the goals there. Self-contained, never trust a device if you don't know where it keeps its brain. I think you touched on that, but that's a pretty cool goal to have. In the secure portion too, like you said, Scenic is designed with an eye toward security. For now, the main effort is to keep it simple. No browser, no JavaScript, or other complexity presenting vulnerabilities. Yeah, it's definitely interesting.
Oh man, there was a really funny point during one of his talks where he was talking about like being paranoid and how like anyone could be watching and all this stuff. And like in the middle of giving this talk, his mic cut out and he went completely dead. He looks around like...
They know.
you couldn't do that again if you tried. So yeah, and then so the way you actually design these UI things is with they're written out as like graphs. He calls them graphs. They're basically just like it's kind of like writing tags on HTML. You kind of nest things in between it and to get kind of levels of hierarchy. And you can, you know, there's like a main graph for like each view, and then like each component has its own graph that you just kind of stick in to the parent view. Hmm. And the graphs are actually compiled, like ahead of time. Like they're functions that you just pipe into each other and pass functions to, but they can be evaluated at compile time, which is cool because you can kind of check the correctness of it. And you also, that just saves resources, right? You don't have to evaluate the scene or the graph every time. It's already, it's just in an attribute. You just say go, just, you know, apply it or whatever. I actually tweeted at him because I looked at this and it, to be honest, the syntax is kind of ugly in the sense that like, it's just you piping a lot of different things into these huge nested trees of things. And I'm like, well, okay, this seems like a perfect case for to take advantage of macros and, you know, write a nice DSL that makes it easier to read and write, but also is, could be extensible, right, to support other components and stuff, and but still be able to generate these graphs. And I tweeted at him and he replied, and it's hard to like, tweets are so short, you can't get a lot out of it, but he basically said that that approach wasn't really so interesting because like by itself is not interesting unless it was like data driven, which I assume means like, he meant like trying to load a UI from a, like a JSON file or something, like some other, like have a UI builder that outputs something and then you could read that in, right? Have like a DSL that's written in some other language.
Right.
It's the best I can figure. But I started trying to write just like a proof of concept DSL for this and I didn't get very far. I might play with it a little more just to see, because I think it could be really, really, really nice.
Yeah, I'm reading the source code actually for the components module. And he's got some examples in the docs for how you pipe into, like you start with a graph and you pipe things into it, like a slider or a text field. That's pretty, that's kind of an interesting way to build a UI. You're just kind of composing it piece by piece like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's literally what it is. And again, he comes from a gaming background. So like you can do things like it's set up like you're designing a game UI in the sense that everything has like, the way you move things around is by transforming matrices, right? So you can have like a slider that like, you know, he shows an example of the slider. You can tilt it and the slider still works because it's able to transform your mouse click into like the coordinate system of that component. So you're like sliding on like an angle and stuff like that. And it's turns out it's really performant to do things that way and really flexible as well. So it comes with a core set of basic components, but obviously he's encouraging people to write their own component libraries.
Yeah, this is so interesting because I don't know anything about making games. And the only way I've ever constructed a UI is through an XML style tree with HTML and view components or React components. So this is like very, very foreign to me to look at. It's interesting though. The documentation looks amazing though.
Oh yeah, he did a lot of work. The docs are huge, like in a good way. And
they look like the Ecto source code.
Yeah, right. And as far as I know, he did this all by himself up to this point. So that's pretty amazing. I mean, he's been doing this pretty much straight. He teased it last year, but didn't release till this year. So he's been working on it a while. Two other points I wanted to make about this. So I was particularly interested in this. I didn't actually know this. I was this interested until after I watched it, was that it ties very, very closely into what we're doing at Remote Ham Radio, where like we have these devices out in the field and we, you know, remote into them and we, you know, want to be able to design hardware that has all these properties that we've talked about, right? Being secure, being, you know, low on resources and so on and so forth. So, and I have this, I kind of want to do this is another idea for proof of concept I have where like he gives an example again with IoT talking about like a smart home. So is the example program that you can just build out of the box is like a thermostat that just shows you the readout of the thermostat, right? Mm-hmm. And again, we do a similar thing in RHR where we just have all these hardware components and we're always reading and writing from them. So I think there's some kind of, for lack of a better word, synergy there for something cool. And I got to play around with it and explore it some more. But what I think is really, really cool is that he actually has like a plan for monetizing this as well. So the Scenic core library is open source, right? That's out there. And what he's doing is he's starting a company called Kry10, Kry10. Mm-hmm. And from what I can tell, it's going to be like a service-based service, a web-based service or something where it kind of facilitates maybe like the management of these devices, you know, securely provisioning them and accessing them. and that kind of stuff. And so that's going to be the business side of it. So he has like a long-term plan for this, which is, I think it's just brilliant and great.
Yeah. That's cool.
You know, open source the tools, let people build their own stuff, but also provide the infrastructure to make that even better. So,
yeah, I mean, like I've been hearing, cause I've been reading a lot about like starting little businesses and things like that. It's foreshadowing, cough. But from what I've been hearing in different communities, like indie hackers, like the business to business route is much easier to get going in than just selling to consumers. And that sounds like what he's doing with that setup. So yeah. Like businesses can undertake his technology, and then he has a solution for them to be able to use them as like first party support and things like that.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely true. Cause like businesses generally are willing to spend money to make right. their jobs easier. Right.
Yeah.
And more money. So yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And that was actually something I skipped, was that the other cool thing about this is that it's insanely remotable, in the sense that, like, for example, like he has a driver that paints the UI to the screen, right? But he also has a driver that serializes the entire graph and spits it across the wire. And so you could be running a local, you know, you remote in SSH in or whatever, and you get like a real secure UI that's exactly replicating what's happening on the remote device, but it's actually, the UI is actually being drawn on your thing because it's just serializing it back and forth. That is pretty cool. You could see exactly what the other person's seeing in real time.
You're not seeing like a virtualized copy of it. You're seeing the real thing.
Right. Yeah. You're not just like getting pixels painted on there. You get the actual controls.
That's pretty cool, man.
It's wild, right?
Yeah.
It's like X Windows system all over again.
Yeah. Which is funny because that's my first, I just started, I was screwing around more with getting my Windows set up how I maybe wanted it. And I just started learning about X Server and using X Server so that way I could run apps running on my WSL install on Windows. I can run those Linux apps in the Windows GUI. And I was like, what is this?
Yeah.
What are these X Server clients? What are these? Like, I don't know any of this stuff. This is all new to me. So
we used to do that in college where the lab computers would have like the installs of the, you know, expensive circuit design software, whatever CAD software we needed to use at the time. But we had real logins to those boxes. So instead of schlepping down to the computer lab, I could just SSH into the box and X11 forward and just do it from home.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's Scenic. I think it's really, really cool. I'm really interested to see where it goes. And I'm actually kind of looking forward to playing with it some more and possibly contributing, because I'm really that enthused about it. I think it's going to be really, really big. And if anyone's going to do it, it seems to be, you know, he's really motivated to make this successful. So
yeah,
that's exciting to see this kind of stuff come up in the community.
Yeah, it is. It's exciting for me that people are excited about that kind of stuff. Like things aren't, feel like there are feelings of like things are happening and there's movement and all that stuff. So that's pretty cool to see.
Yeah. It's that time again.
It's about that time where we ask for feedback and shares and ratings and things. Yeah, we appreciate all of it. We loved hearing from everybody. We love when people just ask questions about things. I'm always happy to answer questions. I'm always happy to talk to anyone that wants to talk about what we talked about on the show. So hit us up.
Yeah, and one way you can give us feedback is hitting us up on Twitter. The show account is @DNCShow. Sean is Sean Washbot, and I am Shruckwell over there.
For every episode, I put the show notes up at dnc.show. So if you want to check out anything we talked about, I usually put links and pictures and things in the show notes so you can find those easily.
I got to see if I can dig up that Stack Overflow JavaScript semicolon post because it's pretty hilarious. If you want to discuss this episode, we're over hanging out in spectrum.chat. We've got all kinds of chat rooms over there for the show and various other development and design resources as well. So come say hi.
And we've also got a job board over at spec.fm/jobs. So if you're looking for a new job, looking for possible new employment, you should check that out. See what's going on over there. As always, we want to thank Spec for having us. It's pretty awesome to be a part of the community that they're building, and pretty happy that they're allowing us to continue to put out content on their network. If you haven't checked out any of the other shows on the network, you should probably do that because they've got some awesome shows like Design Details, which is a weekly conversation about design process and culture. There's a show called Fragmented, and they talk about Android development and just the lives of Android developers. And we mentioned Swift a little bit earlier today, but we also on the network have a show about Swift called Swift Unwrapped. And it's a monthly show where they talk about the latest news from the Swift world.
Yeah, as always, this episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson. Thanks, guys, and I will talk to you later, Sean.
See ya.
Bam.